out here in the perimeter, there are no stars. Out here, we is stoned, immaculate.
Hello and welcome. This is the C86 show. I'm David Eastall. As you know, we love a special guest. This week it's going to be the turn of the Snake Corpse, because I recently spoke to Mark Lewis from the band to find out more about life, love, poetry, and all that other groovy stuff. So this is the interview, so you're going to find out lots more about the band and also their origins. Several members being in the group Sad Lovers and Giants. Anyway, this is Mark. So after several minutes of interesting but casual chat, we get down to that exciting subject that was the early formative years. It's a classic.
Very similar, actually. The first album I bought was Electric Warrior. It was two and six.
Right. I got old money.
Old money. So that would be 1971. And I a bit of pocket money, went out to a local shop and bought that. I've still got it.
Yes. Well, this is very important. I've still got my single, and also my first album was Changes One. So, yeah. And it's still, I even bought that, you used to buy plastic covers for records, didn't you, in those days?
Yeah, it's so marked, and I haven't played it for you. I haven't got a record player anymore.
This is true.
Yeah.
But this is our great flaw in life. Were your parents at all musical? Did they have any musical?
Yeah, my mum was a singer in sort of choirs and things. And my dad played piano and a little bit of trombone.
My God, well, it's always useful, isn't it? So did they give you a bit of a musical push or a little nudge, as they say?
Not really, no. I suppose, yeah, I mean, there was always a piano in the house. So that was, and I did sort of have piano lessons when I was younger.
Yes.
But I started on guitar. As soon as I saw Mark Bolan with a guitar, I thought I've got to have one of those.
And this is true. There you go. Yeah. And how did you have to save up for pocket money, or was it a Christmas present?
Yeah, I think I think it was a Christmas present. I think it was from Woolworth, you know. The strings were like wire, sort of, and about 2 inches off the fretboard, but I managed to get a tune out of it and then went from there, really.
Yes, it's always sort of slightly off-putting, some of those early guitars, which were just impossible for a young
They're impossible to play, yeah.
Which is a bad see, ukuleles make it so much easier now, don't they? You can just put those in the hand and you'll get something.
That didn't look good in front of the bathroom mirror, you know.
No, my God, Mark Bolan. Though I suppose his very early period when he was doing that poetry and John Peel was on the Perfume Garden, that was kind of quite quirky.
What happened after that was you bought Electric Warrior and then you went back to the back catalogues, then you hear all the Tyrannosaurus Rex things. I wasn't really into that, to be honest.
Right.
I liked the electric stuff. And then went on to Bowie, like yourself. He was my hero then.
Yes. And did you have any other older brothers or sisters who might have given you some kind of musical kind of direction? No,
I was the oldest. My brother was more into Simon and Garfunkel and the Beatles and things.
Right. God, yeah. The Beatles. I mean, by 71, 72, Beatles seemed so old hat, didn't they?
Yeah.
It was very strange. Even though they'd only just broken up, it was like that was a different chapter and a different period. So
yeah, all my musician friends love the Beatles. I never really took to them at all, really.
I had an older brother who was 7 years older than me, and he was he had that prog thing going on in the 70s. So I used to sneak into his room and listen to his prog records. But he also had Sgt. Pepper and Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, which I was kind of fascinated by because there was no cultural significance to either of those albums. They were just like, oh, this is very interesting. And I'd seen the Beatles films, like the Monkees films and the Banana Splits. That's slightly different, and I must admit, Sgt. Pepper did have like some fascinating songs, which again were just like that's different, you know, because you know, growing up listening to Gary Glitter and the Bay City Rollers and the Rubettes on Top of the Pops, and suddenly listening to these kind of extraordinary songs by the Beatles. So, and I still love, you know, Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. I think it's a great album. So, when did you go to your first gig? What was your first concert?
I can't remember. I remember I was quite late going to gigs. I remember seeing The Cure very early on, and that was in the late 70s.
Yes.
it was 77 or something. I think 78, maybe. Very. Yeah. It was one of their first tours.
Right.
It was in a very small venue. So that's one I remember back then.
Were you old enough for that punk period? Because to be honest, I was about 12 or 13 when punk hit.
I was about 19 then.
Oh my God, that would have been perfect.
18, yeah. 77, 78.
Had you left school at 16 by then?
Well, I left school, but I was in some sort of education. I think it was in sixth form college. And,
right.
Yeah, that's when I first started playing in bands then.
Right, the college route. Yeah. What was your subjects that you were taking at that stage?
Wow, I can't remember. I think I did, I was doing art. I think economics, law, I think.
Blimey.
Something like that.
God, Mick Jagger would have been impressed with that combination of art and economics. So when you got to did you then go on to university or did you leave at the age of 18, 19?
I did go to Polytechnic, as they were called in those days.
Polytechnics.
That was a little bit later. I left it a little while because you could get a full grant in those days. I think I was about... getting into early 20s. I went to Kingston Poly in Kingston, London.
Perfect.
But it was mainly to help with my music career, really. I wanted to go to London, and there was obviously more things happening there than down in South Wales, where I was at the time. There was nothing in South Wales at that time. I mean, later on, the area became a bit more. You could actually be a band from Wales, but at that time, there was nothing really.
No, absolutely. I remember a bit later on in the 80s, John Peel had a real obsession with the Welsh bands like Daft Bluggy and various people like that. So, so then about 85 to 87, he was championing the Welsh music scene, which was quite exciting. So then, yes, because people forget that in those days, getting a full grant and your housing benefit, sometimes you could even claim housing benefits in...
Well, no, you could sign on the, unemployment legitimately without even... having a job because you were a student at the Easter and at the Christmas holidays and all through the summer holidays.
Yes, so, you could. and I know people who couldn't even be bothered. They just like, oh, I can't be bothered to sign on for the summer holidays. It's, I've got to go down and fill in some forms. So my brother saved money on his grant.
Yeah, it was... sort of good times then.
It was. So look, 79, Thatcher gets in. So we have the next 10 years of Thatcher government. Then we had the Falkland War. Then we had the miners' strike. Then there's Greenham Common. What was your kind of musical moment during this early 80s? Because it was kind of an interesting period. We had punk, post-punk. Then there was that moment of kind of the Blitz Kids and the goth scene happening. And
yeah, it was the Smiths and Cure and things like really got into those sort of bands then. I remember getting into the power pop thing for a bit with bands like XTC, they were, and
they did Pose. They did Pose, didn't they? XTC,
yeah, yes. Amazing. Really good band. And of course, I joined the band, and John Peel helped us out by playing our first single on his show, 10 to 12 show.
Yes,
I think he played every night, 1 week. So,
so how did the band develop? Because at this stage, two of the members, at least, he says, were in Sad Lovers and Giants, weren't they?
Well, I actually auditioned for Sad Lovers and Giants because there were how many? There were about three original members in it that time. Basically, they needed a new singer because the singer had left, and one other member, I think, the keyboard player, had left as well. The rest of them were still there, and I auditioned and obviously got through the audition, and then we started to sort of write new things. And I think because my voice was different, the sound got sort of different and I became a little bit heavier, really.
Yes. There was also
one of the other members left, so we got a new bass player. And eventually the drummer sort of changed around as well. The Sad Lovers and Giants drummer was there for quite a while when we were first recording. yeah, so it all changed around, and then they decided to change the name as well because it was different, and yeah.
So, yes.
Yeah. So it sort of evolved into the Snake Court from Sad Lovers.
Yes. And yeah, because mostly bands or musicians, they kind of have their feel after 5 years, don't they? They don't want to do it anymore. It's all sort of too much. But obviously yeah. The members were keen to carry on.
Yeah, I think that they were keen to carry on because of the change, I suppose it became, you know. I mean, the main driving force was the main songwriter, which was the guitarist. So it gave it a new lease of life, really.
Yes. Did it feel quite intimidating going into a band that had already had such a kind of catalogue already and had so many kind of...
When you're young like that, you don't really worry about it, do you? You just sing and they liked it and that was it. And
yes, absolutely. Because yeah. I have to say, kind of from 83 to 87, you know, it was the years of the Smiths. So for me, indie pop really blossoms into that next chapter. Were you quite interested or influenced by that kind of next kind of wave of bands?
Yeah, I think Sad Lovers are very influenced by The Cure and The Smiths. I think their sound is more like The Smiths and The Cure than The Snake Court. I think The Snake Court sort of lent more. I don't know. A lot of people said we were kind of an indie U2 and things like that. You know, we were a bit more kind of, I don't know, really. It's hard to describe.
Yes. Well, you've got quite an epic, you know, like there's a band called... There's a band called The Chameleons, I'm sure you know them.
Yeah.
But they're, you know, when I listen to their records, they're not at all tinny and thin and a bit weedy. They're quite like kind of made for rock.
They were one of my favourite bands at the time. And in fact, got to know Mark really well because he was on the same label after The Chameleons kind of split.
Right.
He joined the label that was on. And still friends today, actually. And we played a few gigs with them over the years.
Yes, amazing band.
I think
their records are amazing. I think their artwork is a bit sort of surprising, but
I've never really liked the merch stuff, really, the album covers and that. But the music's amazing. Yeah,
yeah. Compared to the Smiths or a lot of bands, they get it really right. Whereas that was like something Marillion would have put together, really. But there you go. That's just
It doesn't really go, does it? Didn't really.
There's nothing. I don't know if it's a member of the band or the girlfriend of a band of a member that has their kind of way. So, was the first time in the studio? Was that to do Science Kills?
Yeah, I think that was one of the first. We didn't have a long to actually do that first album. I think we recorded it in a very short space of time because we had built up the songs by rehearsing them. And so we went into the studio just to record them rather than going into a studio and writing while you're in the studio. And Science Kills was one of the first songs, we did.
Yes.
Yeah.
And did you have many record labels kind of interested in the band at that stage?
Well, we did, and we're on the indie label, Midnight, who, you know, were good, but they didn't have the marketing funds or the sort of networking or the PR to sort of push, particularly in the UK. And there were some other bands. So we spent a long time after the first album because it had been a good success. Trying to get a label that had more resources, if you like, particularly on the marketing side, because to cut through
And did that and did your touring, did you go to Europe much at this
we went to Europe a lot. We didn't do hardly anything in the UK.
Yeah,
we just got offered gigs abroad, in Holland and Spain and, you know, well over, really.
Yes, because one thing I've noticed with quite a few bands, if they get this European audience, there's often one country that really takes them to heart. So sometimes there was one band would like, oh yeah, we're huge in Italy, can't get arrested anywhere else, or Spain. But it was Holland and Spain for you.
Well, Holland early on and Spain a bit later. Spain still, if we play gigs in Spain, we still have a good, really good audience.
So when the I was going to say, with the first album, who was the engineer producer at that? Was that Pat Collier?
Pat Collier, yeah. Who was was he in the Vibrators? I think one of the punk bands, wasn't he?
Yeah, right. He probably was actually. Yeah. And were you pleased with the sound at that stage?
Yeah, yeah. I think actually the record company, the guy who owned it, he produced a lot as well. Nick Ralph. He did a lot. I think he produced most of the, but he's produced Sad Lovers anyway. And he came in and helped as well, to be fair.
Yes.
But engineers have a big influence at that level, you know, because, you know, if you don't have a big producer name coming in, I think engineers have a great sort of influence on what you're doing. And, you know, we thought we had a good ideas as well. So it was a mixture.
And with writing the songs, did you kind of do it as a collective, kind of jamming together, kind of making a sound, or did someone?
No, we never did that. We, myself and the guitarist, Tristan, we lived in a flat in Watford together.
Right.
During that period. And we just wrote songs together.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was going to say, because one of the things about, I mentioned right at the beginning, there were so many bands from the 80s on that indie scene. This is slightly simplistic, but there was kind of a huge amount of unemployment, and a lot of bands were signing on or claiming job seekers allowance or enterprise allowance schemes. So that gave them that 1 year kind of grant, yeah, so to speak. And then they were able to sort of concentrate on their music, which I think makes a huge difference. How did you manage the sort of fun being in the band at this stage?
It's sort of, I'd obviously done a degree, so I managed to get myself a job in a marketing company. I worked for the record company a little bit as well.
Right.
I had some sort of business expertise sort of thing. So it's just part-time and very sort of understanding employers if I needed to go away and do things. So.
God, that is very handy, actually. That was interesting. The band, I did an interview with a member of the Hard-Ons from Australia, and actually he was a student all the way through that. He would just take these long...
Well, I was a student for the first... first year.
Yes.
Yeah, so that was a bit of a struggle.
And he just had to sort of like time everything's like, right, okay, that's the last day. Now we're going to have to do the album, do the tour, and I'll have to be back in about 3 months' time. Yeah. I think it was being a nurse, which has kind of slightly surprised me. From their image. So as the 80s progressed, obviously there was kind of getting very excited politically with things, as I mentioned, the miners' strike and things like Red Wedge. Did you sort of get any kind of influence or pressure to be part of any movement at that stage?
No, not really. I mean, we weren't really a political kind of band at all, really. I mean, I certainly lyrically, there was nothing there to attach ourselves to any political movement. I mean, personally, I was sort of involved because I'd grown up in South Wales and my grandfather was a miner. My mum come family were miners family, so obviously that influenced me. And I wasn't much of a Thatcher lover, put it that way.
No.
We did some charity things at that time, or sort of causes on the left, as it were.
Yes, there was a lot about, wasn't there, at that stage? Yeah. I think, I don't know if there was Rock Against Racism, all that had already been and gone. So when after the first album had come out, what was the kind of the next part and the next narrative of the band at this stage?
Well, what we decided we wanted to try to get, as I say, perhaps a record company with a bit more resource there so we could, do bigger tours. You know, progress, you know.
Yes.
Numerically. It's not the actual size of the band, the size of the sort of bank balance, really. I don't know. You know what I mean?
Ever have a manager at that stage?
Yeah, we tried a couple of managers, yeah. We had a guy from Scotland. He was pretty good. We did a Scottish tour, actually, because of that. We had a couple of managers, and we met a lot of record companies, majors even. You know, we managed to get in to see a few A&R men, but it was, at that time, we'd go in and we'd obviously had the album out, so they'd, you know, we thought they'd listen to the music, and they gave us an interview. And I remember one of them saying, have you ever heard Prince? And he goes, yeah, you know, we have Prince. He said, can you be a bit more like him? yeah, like he's a bit of a one-off, you know what I mean? So that's the level of the A&R, wow, sort of image record companies. And they always wanted to. The thing is, what we realized is that on every major label, they had one band that a genre, and they wouldn't want any more. And do you know what I mean? It was, they just want to put all their resources into very few amount of artists.
Right.
It's a very, well, it makes sense, doesn't it? To make one band really huge rather than five bands sort of slightly huge. That's the way they work, really.
Yeah. It's, I mean, it was, I suppose today, it was disappointing. There was like 4AD, there was Creation, there was Rough Trade, you know, there was even smaller ones. So there was just, and, you know,
we started at the top and sort of went down.
There were some really small ones, 50,000.
In the end, we had enough, we had a lot of songs. We'd been, you know, we had still been playing and doing gigs, and we decided we'd just stay where we were and bring out the second album then.
Yes. Yeah. And as a sort of a creative force, did you have certain existential moments? Because obviously there was the kind of the great moment in 87, the JFK moment. When, where were you when you heard the Smiths had broken up? And then, you know, that kind of indie pop world had slightly started to feel like that door was closing. And then Ecstasy comes along, and then the dance scene comes along.
Yeah, the dance scene was a, you know, that was a big, and I think early 90s when we were, I think Ivana, as soon as I heard that, I thought, that's it, you know. That's like, let's give up, yeah.
Yeah, I was, yeah, because it is, you know, because you had a bit of shoegaze, and so you had this label called Sarah Records, but obviously they were just happy to play in small art centres, apart from in Japan where they're huge, which is quite random. But, you know, it was like very small, wasn't it? It was like almost like a fanzine record label. Yeah.
And well, then your fanzines were were a big thing at the time.
Yes. And what was, because the interesting thing with the band is that a lot of people, everyone says, oh, we didn't want to be part of the scene, but it's like, well, quite clearly, you know, you all dressed in black and you sound like a goth band. So you're a goth and you're an indie band, and, you know, shoegazing.
Goth didn't exist then. There was no sort of goth that came later, and we were we're playing a gig in Poland next, when is it? 7th of October.
Yes.
It's a goth festival. So, but goth, we weren't a goth band at all. We didn't know what that sort of.
Well, we had the Bat Cave, didn't we? And Alien Sex Fiend. And then we had the bands, like there was Susie and The Cure. And then there was The Mission and The Cult and the Sex Gang Children.
The Cure was never, you know, when I first saw them, they dressed with cowboy bandanas. And, you know, white jeans and.
Yes.
Yeah. So.
I'm very small. Yeah, this is true. So I just wondered how you were sort of managing to sort of work out. Because you did, I mean, there was one particular track which is an instrumental, which is kind of this amazing emotive song. So you quite, the band were very creative, weren't they? You weren't sort of, you had some kind of interest in sonic sounds.
We didn't want to just keep a formula going. If something sounded good, and we'd you know, go for it.
Yes.
You know, I think that was probably not a great idea, because if you look at the kind of way that bands are successful, they've stick to the formula, you know. But we didn't. We just went off and did lots of different things. And the third album was so different to the first, the third cup. I mean, that was, I think that's more kind of, I don't know. I remember the band The Church from the Australian band.
Oh, yes.
I think a lot of people said there was a lot of influence from them. I did like them in that third album. It was a bit more kind of psychedelic lyrics. And
what was a typical fan like? Who, you know, when you looked at the audience, was there a particular type?
I don't think I'm being sexist. We thought, oh, it would be great if they were all women, you know, girls. But
yes,
it was mostly... mostly guys, sort of geeky guys like us.
Yes, because musically it's kind of quite intricate, isn't it? It's almost, did anyone in the band, did they like people like Steve Howe or Yes or Barclay James Harps?
I think that Simon, Tristan, he was in sort of, yes, I think before the, you know, they become unfashionable and we don't mention it anymore. But I think, yeah, he had a couple of Yes albums, I think. Yeah.
Because it does have that kind of feeling, you know, underneath the surface of something that's quite sophisticated and, you know, people who really knew how to play their instruments and weren't content to just bashing out some very simplistic indie song.
No, it became quite sophisticated, the music, yeah. Well, for contemporary music, it's not that sophisticated. If it is, it won't work. But it did become that. So there was lots of interchanging with keyboards and guitars. Lots of guitar overdubs on the last couple of albums.
Yeah. Yes, oh, we love overdubs, don't we? So when you went in the studio to record the second album, which is Smother Earth, what studio did you go to for that?
Well, Lasker was the first one, which is underneath Waterloo Station, sort of under the arches. And the train, you can actually hear the trains going to stop recording sometimes.
Right.
Second place we recorded was, do you know, I can't remember. I think we did something there. I think Berry Street, I think.
Right.
Clerkenwell. They're all in London, the studios we used. Yeah.
And had the lineup stayed the same as the first album?
The bass player changed. Tristan's brother, Jim Blanchard, he came in and played bass on the second album. Yeah.
Right, so he was there on it. Did that change the? Did that shift the music at all?
Not really. Not, I mean, a bit of a disservice to bass players, but you know, it's yeah. The bass became a little bit more sort of bassy, if you like.
Because I suppose, you know, with that period, and it's been kind of interesting, because there were bands like The Sound, weren't there? And also The Trees, and like I mentioned, The Chameleons. So they were, when I listen to it now, it, you know, there's like, oh, this is a lot more sophisticated than, I don't know, The Wedding Present or, I don't know, Jesus and the Mary Chain, or We've Got a Fuzz Box and We're Going to Use It. There is a sort of an interesting kind of quality to the sound, which makes you kind of want to listen, you know, on repeat, because it's kind of got a lot of depth to it. So so that's why I was kind of curious.
That was the idea, to bring it out of that sort of, you know, punk world, out of the three chords, out of the, you know, the, as you say, the very distorted punk sound. Funny you said Jesus and Mary Chain, because we recorded in Alaska when they were in the other studio.
Right.
They were so loud, we had to stop playing with them. It's like, and the feedback was crazy. Yeah.
Yes, that must have been very, very trying. Yes. So when you were recording the second album, what was the atmosphere like with the band at that stage? Were you feeling optimistic?
Yeah, it was good. That was a nice time. We were always good friends. I mean, obviously, I lived with the guitarist in the same flat, so we had to be, you know, get on all right. We were fine. Yeah, yeah.
Yes. What was the reception like with the second album?
Yeah, it was good. I think we had some good reviews, if I remember.
Did you?
It was a lot of work went into that album. They put a lot of tracks on it, and they did, I think, when the CD came out, because the CDs had started around that time, there was quite a lot of tracks. I think there was 15, 16, you know. So we did a lot of recording around that time and sort of put it on this album. I loved that album. I think,
can you remember the recording process for a track like This Is Seagull? How did that song come about?
A lot of those instrumentals were played around with. They're more studio. There was more written in studio and things, and you know, there'd be guitars and keyboards. I mean, I remember that track was much slower, they tweaked it and speeded it up a little bit, and it kind of really worked then. It got that feel. I mean, that track was lucky in a way, because it was a B-side of Calling You, and it was used by a Real Madrid footballer as his Keepy Uppy video, and that's why it's so subscribed on sort of YouTube and things like that, because we've got loads of Real Madrid fans, presumably.
Yeah, a million and a half. That's what I was like. What? That was extraordinary. And what about a track like Calling You? How did that come about? Can you remember also the kind of the way that developed?
Yeah, I think I had that in my head sort of rather than anywhere else really. And I think it was two kind of songs and then we merged it into one. So the chorus was another song and the verse was, yeah. So, yeah, we managed to sort of merge it. It had this very big chorus, didn't it? It was like an anthem. I wanted to have a bit of an anthem song, like Calling You, and yeah, that sort of thing. That's what it was about. It's quite goth, though.
Yes.
It's quite dark in the verses, yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting time. And did you tour that particular album? Did you go through and around Europe?
We never did that sort of tour albums. We just kept playing when we were offered to do some dates, usually abroad. We just go and do them. And obviously we played the majority of the songs that, you know, we could do live. I mean, we couldn't do everything live at that time.
No.
Yeah.
Interesting time. So then we get into the John Major years, the 90s appear, and then we definitely do have Nevermind and grunge is there. So what did you ever have any kind of conversations about what to do with the band after the second album?
Probably. I can't remember. Yeah, I think so. I think we wanted to actually, I think we've been following this thing to go for the songs to be a bit more, I wouldn't say commercial, but to be more accessible. And on the third album, we thought, right, no, we're just going to write what we want to write here. We're not going to, you know, follow this plan.
And that was,
and we spent a lot of time on that album. Yeah.
And then also on a different, so by then had Midnight, were they still operating or did they let you?
Midnight, I think just got into some sort of financial thing. They had a lot of artists, Midnight, and a lot of stock and things like that. And I think in the end, it sort of couldn't sort of keep on going with this sort of big roster and that. There were a few bands that were selling decent amounts and quite a lot of the other bands. I mean, it was laudable in a way that they took on so many sort of indie bands, but the resources weren't enough to sustain them, I don't think.
Yes.
And also
by the late 80s, you'd had all that problem with the rough trade distribution.
Yeah, the distribution was more difficult, you're right, yeah.
It took out a few record labels and bands at that stage as well, didn't it?
Well, it wouldn't be a problem now, would it?
No.
Just put it on.
That's one of the easier things in life.
Yeah, that's the easier thing. Yeah.
So what was the label you went to for this, for your third release?
It was a friend of one of the band members who'd worked in the record industry. And I mean, it really was a distribution deal rather than a record deal, because we'd already got the recordings. We owned them because we'd paid for them ourselves. So it was a distribution sort of arrangement, because at that time, obviously CDs was the main.
The CD had appeared, actually. Does that mean that Cherry Red Records owned your record?
Well, yeah, they then took those first two albums, and I think we did another album called More Than the Ocean as well in that time. There was a few covers on there and things like that, like Crimson and Clover, and there's a couple of original songs on there and some longer versions of some of the other songs that we'd already released. There was four albums in total, although we called it the third cup. There'd actually been four. It's confusing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, so had there been a release between Smother Earth and Third Cup then?
I think so. Yeah, it was called More Than the Ocean. It was, and that song was a new song, I think, on it. And Strangers, which is one of the best songs live for us. That was on that as an original song on there. And as I say, there was, there's a couple of Sad Lovers Jaya songs we redid them on that album.
Yes. Blimey. Yeah. So where did you, what studio did you go to for your...
That was definitely Berry Street for the third cup. That was...
Right. And how did you kind of...
We'd used it before and...
And who was your producer for that one?
That was Brad Gilbert. Yeah, he was a Canadian guy. He was great. He was real. Yeah, we really liked the band and we got on with him really well. And he was quite sort of... he came up with good ideas and that's probably the best produced album actually.
And had your guitar playing changed much at that time?
Well, I wasn't. The thing is, when you got such a good guitarist, you know, what's the point in putting a not so good guitarist on there? But there are some of my guitar on, and I played bits of keyboards and things, and but mainly I did. Mainly was the vocals. That was my job. So
yes.
Yeah.
And with tracks like Siren Song, how did that one develop and come together?
Well, that was interesting because we had a deal with they had these things at that time. We had development deals and we had one with Island Records and they took us on a development for it was about a year actually, and we went in and did lots of recordings of different things. And a couple of those songs, like the Siren Song, were development songs that we had with them. And I think it was a totally different lyrics. I changed the lyrics on that one. We changed the lyrics. Obviously, I was into mermaids at the time. So
yes, absolutely. With lyric writing, what was the general process that you used? Was there any particular way you went about writing?
Yeah, I kind of cheated a bit, to be honest. I used to look in things like quotes and, you know, books of quotes and poetry, and just I never copied them or anything, but it would just give me an idea. I like sort of romantic poets, and I'm a big fan of Dylan Thomas because from where I'm from. So I was into the kind of more poetic kind of lyric.
Yes. A bit like David Bowie doing his cut-ups.
Oh, the cut-ups, yeah. I tried that. It didn't work for me, but, yeah, because I wasn't David Bowie, so...
Were you able to sort of... did writing, was that something that you would be able to do quite quickly and quite efficiently, or did it sort of drag on sometimes?
It would go quick once you're in the zone, sort of thing. Once you knew that you were right, you were going in the right direction, you know, had the chorus line. I tend to try to get the chorus line and then write the narrative around it.
Right.
Fit, yeah.
A good chorus.
That makes sense, yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Then you fitted it together. Yeah. And the track like Yesterday With You, can you remember how that one sort of came together and was shaped?
I can't. I mean, a lot of the time we'd be in a rehearsal or something, and I'd be singing any old nonsense or something, and then a line would come out, and I think that was one of those songs, and it was kind of an interesting thing to have Yesterday With You. I remember saying to someone said to me, he said, "I like that song, Yesterday With You." I said, "I like that." He said, "I'd like to spend yesterday with you," and I thought, I think he was insulting me, but anyway.
Nice. And once that album, because this was a period where sort of obviously we still had the grunge world, but Britpop was appearing, wasn't it? Did you feel there was a sort of musical shift again with as the 90s progressed?
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, as I say, the Nirvana sort of grunge thing, that sort of put me a bit off kilter really, because I thought what we were doing was unfashionable, if you like. You know, we weren't on trend anymore. As a new phrase, although on trend didn't exist then.
No.
And that was a bit off-putting. And then of course you had the sort of the Oasis and Blurry thing going on, didn't you?
Yes, it all changed.
I didn't like that at all. But I've kind of don't mind it so much now. I thought Oasis were quite sort of, as you say, very basic, mostly just following chord structures of Beatles songs. And Blur were just too art schooly for me, really, and a bit too clever.
Yes.
So didn't get on with them.
Well, it was also quite a lot of bands decided to put a little orchestral moment in the sort of the lineup as well.
Like,
There was My Life Story and Mark Almond and various other people all suddenly had this string section appearing. And it's like, well, that's interesting. I mean, I quite enjoyed the fact that people were playing guitars and it all looked quite immediate and kind of had that energy.
It was good that there were guitar bands still, because that even that was a worry, I think. Well, as it is now, I mean.
Yes, this is true. Mm. Did you tour that particular album? Did you go abroad for that?
We started to get a bit of an audience in Spain around the sort of early 90s. Yeah, we went to Spain quite a lot. Yeah. But so we didn't sort of, as you say, we didn't have a joined up, you know, marketing campaign or anything. And we'd do a tour off the back of an album and all the publicity. You know, we weren't, it wasn't that sophisticated, I'm afraid.
A master plan. Yes, this is true. So did you have a moment in 94-ish where you all kind of decided what to do with the band? Did it have any kind of conversation about it continuing or not continuing?
Yeah, there was a kind of feeling, you know, in any relationship you get to sort of a point where you think this is not, it's probably not working as well as it did. And I think we just thought we'd take a break. In fact, we did take a break and we were going to do another tour, and the guitarist Tristan, he hurt his finger. He'd sort of chopped the top of it off a bit doing something, and so he couldn't play, so we had to pull out of that. And we kind of never did anything else then until more recently, until the sort of, you know, 2008 2009 we sort of started back together again.
Is it the case then? Oh, did you ever play any festivals? Did you do any kind of?
We did festivals in Holland, but they were, I mean, festivals weren't that big in the 80s. I mean, I remember going to Glastonbury, it was just full of mud and a few hippies.
Yes.
It wasn't like it is now. And the festival thing isn't as big as it is now. There were, you know, young people went to festivals in those days, older people didn't. I mean,
Festivals
just full of 60-year-olds now, aren't they, really?
basically, you just had. You had Reading and Glastonbury and Stonehenge, didn't you? Possibly Stonehenge. And I mean, that was a bit of an arco.
Nedworth, wasn't it? That was the heavy.
Oh, yes, there you go. So, but then you had Reading that appeared in the 90s, but no festivals. It was on the continent.
Yeah, there
was you were
nothing
playing.
Like it is now, yeah.
So what happened in 2000? Did you at that stage then just put the guitar away and sort of get on with your, you know, day job?
Well, yeah. I guess, you know, life things, events happen, you know, you get married, you have children, and you know, you have to get a proper job sort of thing.
Yes, this is true. This happened.
That sort of took over for a while, and I think it's good to have a break from something. Everyone thinks it's be quite enjoyable being in a band and playing all the time, and it is, but you get fed up with anything you do if you do it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, especially because there is a lot of responsibility, but there's a lot of struggle, isn't there? That isn't, from what I've been told, it's quite hard work and quite frustrating. And yes, making music is great, but it's all the bits around it that trying to get people to
wake up really was, you know, the internet really, because then you had, because you have all these dispersed sort of fans, if you like, around the world. And they all come together on the web. So whereas they would just, you'd never know, would you, before then, that they all existed. So you do, you know, they revitalized a lot of bands, I think, having websites, having social media come in and having fans being able to connect with you.
Yeah, well, absolutely. So what was the moment in 2008 that, did you get a phone call?
I met up with, I went to see a gig with Tristan playing. He was playing in a country and western band in Tring. And I went to see him, and then the bass player was there and the drummer was there, and we all chatted. And eventually some of them didn't come want to do it. The drummer didn't want to come back and do it. We got the band back together. Three of the sort of originals got back together, and yeah.
And did you, apart from sort of thinking this is a good idea, did you get an offer to play some gigs or do some
shows? Yeah, we did. We did, actually. It was in Spain, and we played with Sad Lovers. And the Essence, they were on the label. So it was like a label thing. We played in Barcelona in, I think that was 2009 or 2010, somewhere around there. And we played there and then kind of just a little bit of thinking about writing some songs, which we did in the end. And where we are now, really, we do 4 or 5 gigs a year in nice places. And and we're still doing some writing, I think. Yeah, I do anyway.
Yes, well, absolutely. Because you bought a single out. You've had a few singles quite recently, haven't you?
We just do tracks now because, you know, it's that's the way it's done, isn't it? You just do something and you can release it and, you know.
On Bandcamp, actually. There you go. Yeah. And is it the case that when you get enough, you'll put it together on an album?
I think so. I think so. Yeah, I think that'd be good to package them up. That'd be a nice thought.
It would be a nice thought. And then you just get the odd phone call from somebody, a promoter, who says, "Could you play this kind of festival event?"
Yeah, that's the way it works. Yeah.
And the next one you've got, this is going to be in Poland, isn't it? On the 5th of October. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So is it the case? So did the lineup change again at this stage?
Yeah, the original bass player became the guitarist, and myself, and the bass player stayed on bass, basically.
And did it seem, yes, how did you cope with that kind of emotional moment that Tristan wasn't part of it? Did that feel difficult?
Well, he toyed with the idea of doing it, but... I think at that time he had other things that, you know, he was doing. So, yeah, no, it was fine. I mean, you just have to get on with it then, don't you?
Well, yes, absolutely. I mean, and carry the flag of the band, exactly. Actually. Yeah. And to, yes, all these aspiring interests. And so do you sort of manage the website and the Bandcamp page? And...
Well, I wouldn't call it manage. All I did was make sure that Instagram had a widget on the website and that keeps it up to date. And I do very little social media, to be honest. I mean, I spend most of my time, well, not most of my time, but will do in Spain because my partner is from Spain. So,
right.
Move back and forth.
Yeah. Yes, this is all good. So have you got plans? Because you've done a single quite recently, haven't you? Which was Ghost.
Ghost. Yeah. That was kind of written during the latter stages of the lockdown. And that was interesting because we did it all basically sharing files online, so we didn't even have to get together. I just recorded all the vocals and the guitars, then were done, and the drums were all done different time.
Yes. And the previous single, which had come out about 4 years ago, She'll Rise, was that done?
I really like that song, actually, and I like that song. It's not really a live song. It's very much a studio piece, I think. But,
Did you come together in a studio to record that?
I did the vocals in a studio with the drummer, actually. His brother has helped produce it. So, Alex.
Do you find that at the moment, though, because I know Sad Lovers are sort of doing the odd date here and there. Have you found that there's an audience of people who are very committed to supporting the band to keep it going, you know, to try and see you at least once a year? Well,
we do get Sad Lovers fans, and, you know, I don't know if they get ours as well, but there is a crossover. Yeah.
I just noticed that there's kind of a lot of bands who just will come out once or twice a year, do a couple of nice shows, and then that's it. And then occasionally, you know, go into the studio, record another record. And I just wondered if you feel like that's quite a nice little, I suppose, I know it sounds a dirty word, a business model.
Well, I don't know if it's a business model. Presumably
a hobby model.
There to make money. And we don't.
No, this is not, but, you know, but it's manageable.
Yeah, it's manageable. And, you know, we're not getting any younger. And it's, you know, it's quite an energetic sort of thing to do. You know, have to get in shape before the gigs, you know.
Yes. And what do you do for your as you prepare, because it's a month's time for Poland? Do you start working out?
We have a rehearsal. Yeah. I try to work out. I mean, the singing style is quite, is a, you know, it's not, I'm not how shall I put this? I'm kind of a singer rather than a vocalist, you know, so I'm not sort of standing there with a lot of reverb singing sort of mid-range. I've got quite a big sort of vocal sound, so you need to keep in shape for it.
Yes, absolutely. Vocal, yeah. Do you do vocal warm-ups and vocal training?
Well, the training is, I do actually. And sometimes I've been in Wales and I've been playing some gigs with my old band that I was in school with, just to keep the vocals going. Because if you don't, it's like any other muscle, it will, you know, start to deteriorate, I think.
Yes, absolutely.
You've got to work it and get up there in the high registers. I haven't yet started lowering the keys, which a lot of singers do because they can't reach the higher notes when they get older. So I haven't right got to that stage yet.
Well, it's quite a nice challenge to see how long you can stay in that range.
Exactly.
Before.
That's my challenge.
This is what I have with Park Run. You know, I don't like to let it slip too much because I think that's it. That's decline and deterioration.
Well, I'd like to meet people. There's a park here, but I've never seen anybody, well, people running in it other than individuals, but that'd be a nice thing to do.
It would be, yeah, it's good. Yeah. So do you have kind of a wealth of kind of material that you think that would be really nice to get recorded one day? That's
I've got quite a lot of lyrics backed up. It's just a matter of me kind of working them into basic kind of songs and then giving them to the rest of them to work their magic, really.
Yes, absolutely. And do you, after this autumn winter that we're about to face, have you got any plans for next year, sort of 2024?
Yeah, we've got two gigs penciled in for Spain, which is Valencia and Barcelona, and that's sort of maybe February, March.
Yes.
We seem to be annual guests at this the gig in Germany in Meschede. Brilliant gig. It's a lovely forest. I don't know how many people there is, 1,500, 2,000, but it's a lovely festival over a weekend. And we've played there the last 2 years.
Fantastic.
Mostly post-punk sort of goth bands. But it's a fantastic setting. Yeah. Other than that, not yet, but things always crop up.
I would imagine, yes.
Yeah, talk about Paris as well, but yeah.
Totally continental. Did you ever play in America? Did the band ever cross over?
No, that would have been, that was one of our kind of ambitions, but we never managed to get there.
Yes. And do you sort of play any dates in the UK now, or is that very rare?
Yeah. No, we played Brighton last September. Yeah, we did a gig.
Oh, yes. In fact, it was the 10th of September last year, wasn't it? There you go. I was thinking, oh, that's amazing. You're going to be doing an interview on the same day as a gig. And then I thought, oh, no, it was last year. I thought it was quite amazing. So, look, if you could have whispered something like your 16-year-old self starting out in music, is there anything in particular you would have told them as a little bit of a word of wisdom?
Oh, God, that's a difficult one. I think... I don't know. I could say lots of things about business, which should be boring. I just think stick at it and don't give up.
Yes.
Just keep going. And I know a lot of people say that, but it's true. You know, and when you think that nothing's going to happen from it, and just enjoy it. It doesn't really matter what level you are, or, you know, just enjoy doing it and keep on going. Just keep on going. And as long as you want to, I think that'll be my advice.
Yes, absolutely. No, it's always the best. And do you own any of the music, or is that world of publishing and the master tapes?
Well, we're kind of clever enough not to sign publishing on the second album. A lot of record companies give you these deals and they say, oh, you signed this one as well.
Yes.
You just do because you're young. So we, myself and Tristan, have a sort of publishing partnership on the songs from that time onwards.
Fantastic. Is it easy to get the third album?
Yeah, well, it's because, as I say, it was a distribution deal, so there's I think there's some talk about re-releasing it on CD, which would be easy enough, really, but I don't see the real point of that. And who buys CDs now? I suppose people do. yeah, it should be on Spotify, shouldn't it? We'll have to sort that out.
I don't think it is. I think you've got
it's not on Spotify now. I think it's available. I mean, you can get most of the tracks from YouTube. They're all there, aren't they? They're all the tracks are on YouTube, so
right
and available. Right. But it's not in any sort of proper format, if you like.
No.
Yeah, it needs sorting out actually. We'll have to.
Bandcamp. I guess it would be Bandcamp is the go-to place.
Yeah, you could do it on Bandcamp, yeah.
Yes. Have you found that it's been quite a successful kind of platform for sort of releasing the singles?
Yeah, it's okay. I mean, Spotify is, you get more listeners on Spotify. The streaming service is generally Amazon and Apple and all those. Yeah.
But I noticed
I see them coming through all the time and yeah.
Yeah, are you finding new audience members, new audiences for the music?
Well, it's hard to tell, really. It's hard to tell. I don't know. I mean, certainly in the gigs, you see people think you couldn't have never. We weren't probably born with this when we were playing, so there are younger people sort of getting into it somehow. Yeah. But most of the audience are you know in their late 50s, 60s, you know, and. I guess eventually they'll all be gone.
But the younger generation are always a bit like us, I guess, always liking to find that obscure band to become.
Yeah, there's a little bit of that. Yeah, people tend to write to me and you know say, I'm you know just discovered your band and you know I'm 25. Yeah, you get that. Yeah.
Yes, and if someone said. You know, like what three tracks would you recommend for somebody who's never heard the band before? What would you recommend?
Okay. Well, I think Science Kills is probably a good one to start with, very early sort of thing. I really like the Siren song. I'm glad you mentioned that. I think that's a great track. It's quite sophisticated. It's the most sophisticated kind of thing we did. And Something Wrong, I like that. Something Wrong, that's quite
something
nice.
Wrong, yeah, right?
It was a little,
yes, interesting. I will, yeah. No, okay. I've loved listening to the music, it's been fantastic. So, yes, well, look, thank you ever so much for giving me the time for this, it's been brilliant. And if you want, I can always send you a link and then you can put it on your Facebook page and
sure. Well, yeah,
that would be brilliant. But look, good luck in Poland next month, which
thank is very much.
Do you just have to get together one for one rehearsal to
one or two to generally
is the band scattered all over?
Yeah, we're scattered all over. Yeah,
tricky.
All over the continent. Yeah.
Oh wow, that is tricky. Anyway, look, have a lovely Sunday and thank you again for the
thank
your
you
time.
Thanks. And your time too. Yeah.
Take care. Thank you. Bye bye.
It's me. Bye bye.
Bye-bye. That, dear listener, is the end of the interview. Massive thank you to you, Mark, for giving me the time for that. This has been the C86 Show, David Eastall. If you want to contact me, you can. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Just do C86 Show. I am here. And keep it positive, please. Thank you. And all these interviews have been archived. Aren't you lucky? You can find those on Spotify, iTunes, Podbeam. It's true. Have a great week. Stay safe.